I wanted to go over to John Gray, who has a somewhat different view. Many of you have read his books, seen his writing in a variety of publications. He's now formally emeritus professor of European thought at the London School of Economics. John, a few thoughts on the survival of the euro.
Thank you very much. I think over the medium term of 10, 15, possibly 20 years, it can't survive. Of course, it has been stabilized through the crisis of the last year or so, and many supporters of the euro, going back 20 years when I heard a talk by Oscar Fischer stating this view, anticipated that there would be great crises and argued that the result of the crises would be to strengthen the euro. So for supporters of the euro, this is not anything new. But I don't think the euro has been strengthened. It's been stabilized at the level of the currency and the banking system, but at enormous social and human and economic cost in the Mediterranean countries. I don't think we sufficiently grasp the depth of the human and social damage involved in nearly two-thirds of Spanish youth, that's to say people under 25, being outside the labor market, unemployed for many years, with many years on current policies, even if they're tweaked at the edges after the recent election in Germany. Many years of policies producing maybe 5 or 7 or 10 more years of mass unemployment in large parts of Europe. What will be the fates of these young people, not even looking at the older ones for the time being, if they've been out of the labor market for 5, 10, 15 years? It's a recipe, I think, for profound social alienation and ultimately for political instability. But the ultimate reason why I don't think the euro can survive is that, as supporters of the euro constantly remind us, it'll only work with banking union, and ultimately banking union, fiscal transfers, all the rest of it can only work with political union. And I don't think a political union in a Europe of this size, a eurozone, a euroland of this size, maybe if it was smaller, if it had stayed smaller, if it had been a monetary union of a few closely similar countries, it could have endured and possibly, or possibly not, turned into a political union. But at the size that it is now, with the membership that it has now, I think there cannot be anything like a functioning democracy. And more generally, although I'm no fan of the nation state or of nationalism, the lesson of the last decades and of much of the last century is that the upper limit of democracy and also of political legitimacy is the nation state. There are a few multinational nation states left in the world, Canada, Spain, Belgium, the United Kingdom, but they're all relics of monarchy or empire. There are no functioning transnational democratic institutions, and I don't think there will be. Now, of course, you can take the view that we can't know in advance what's possible or impossible. If something looks impossible, we should test it in the experimental laboratory of history. That's been a disaster throughout the 20th century. I don't think this promises to be different, where Europe is a zone of peace. One of the achievements of the European Union in its earlier phase was a long period of peace. It was built largely by the people who supported it, primarily, and before it was an economic union as a means of peace. But we've also seen in more recent times that when conflict breaks out in the European continent, as it did in the Balkans, the European institutions were powerless to intervene. Unless there'd been an intervention by American armed force, unless American power was exercised as it was, there would have been no resolution of the Balkan conflict of the kind that there has. The European institutions are now heavily involved there, but they couldn't have been heavily involved there if American power hadn't been employed as it was, in terms of sort of its reach into the Balkans and that part of the post-communist world. It was pretty useless. So I think my view is it can't survive. Just to speak of my own country, there may be a referendum on the Europe on EU membership. On EU membership, I don't think there are any practicable political circumstances in which Britain could, in any foreseeable time, join the euro. I think that's off the agenda, probably permanently. Equally, however, it's quite feasible that if there is a referendum, and there'll only be a referendum at the moment because Labour has declined to commit itself to a referendum, if another coalition is formed with the Conservative Party in the dominant seat, if there is a referendum, I think it could well not deliver the result of an exit result. That's to say, to put it the other way around, I think the preference of the British voters might be to remain semi-detached and not to decide. So in that case, there might be a relatively narrow win. So the preference of the majority, the British majority, and of thereby, ultimately, of the political class, I think, is to remain semi-detached. And in that context, whatever happens in Europe, and if Europe does become more integrated prior to what I view as an eventual collapse, Britain will become more semi-detached as Europe becomes more integrated. Whatever happens in Europe, Britain will not take part in the experiment. And I'm myself glad that that is the case, because although what happens in Europe affects us greatly, although we have a tremendous amount of trade with Europe, the deep commingling of fates that's involved in joining a project of political union, which I regard as essentially impossible of achievement, I think is one which the British public, the British voters, will reluct from and will continue to reluct from, partly because had we been in the euro, had we joined as, for example, Blair is one of his kind of, one of his many visions by which he was intoxicated, was that after we'd joined the United States in a quick war of weeks or 2 or 3 months in Iraq, and Blair had been swept through Baghdad with flowers thrown over him and so on, he would come back. It's not made up. This is what he, I think, had in mind for a while. There would be a quick referendum on entering the euro, and we'd have gone in. Had we gone in, we would now be in a position rather like that of ERA, Ireland, multiplied by about 10. So the fact that we've stayed out, the fact that the so-called austerity policies, which are not that austere, have prevailed, by the way, partly because we've been able to devalue our currency, which we wouldn't have been able to do if we'd been in. That's what really did it, having continuing control of our own currency. The British people, without paying deep attention to this, because Europe is about seventh or eighth on their list of priorities, any aspect of Europe, have the sense, the unconscious sense, that we're much better off out of it and will remain out of it pretty well whatever happens. If it breaks down, and then I'll conclude, if it breaks down, how will that affect the world? Well, I think one of the risks here is to have an introverted European perspective. A breakdown of the euro, a collapse of the euro, would certainly be a very large event, and it would certainly affect many parts of the world. But it wouldn't be larger than in the impact on the world than that of a Chinese economic collapse, or even a rapid slowdown, or to take a more likely possibility, although I don't say it's very likely, a failure of Abenomics, a large-scale failure of Abenomics, could have an absolutely cataclysmic effect on the world economy. So Europe isn't at the center of the world, even in the event of a cataclysm. There are many other things that could happen which would be equally or more cataclysmic. Back in 1919, the poet Paul Valéry wrote a wonderful essay on the future of Europe, in which, by the way, he said the secret European dream is to be governed by an American commission. I think under all the anti-Euro-Americanism, I think that's still a kind of dream. He said, we are too burdened to buy our history. Perhaps we can sort
John, let's return to some
sure
of those.
I'm sure
you
have
lots to respond to. I think we'd try and put it a little bit in the context, and you already have to some degree, about whether the euro should survive and what would happen if it doesn't. And I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on democracy. One of the ironies in the U.S. and in Europe is that the purely non-democratic Federal Reserve and the ECB were the ones who had the most, in the American term, liberal policies, and who, by and large, have so far at least saved the day. But John, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll say something about whether it ought to survive, and then something about the consequences of it not surviving if that happens. I hesitate to quote a European dictator, particularly not one one who was not known for his sense of humor, but Mussolini observed somewhere, it's his only recorded joke, if he meant it as a joke, that ruling Italy was not impossibly difficult, simply pointless. And I guess at the back of this is the idea that if this absurd project founders, then we have chaos, catastrophe, disaster, murder, that it's the only possible, that there is no alternative to it. James Galbraith has already pointed to a number of alternatives that could perhaps be explored within the existing structures, though I'm doubtful myself if any of them will be explored in time and on a large enough scale to prevent a further crisis. So I think it would be better now to start thinking about how to adapt to a major crisis further down the road. We can't know. It could be because of an external event. It could be because of internal political developments. But let me just underscore one point, which is a feature which has been commented upon by James and others, but which I think is not sufficiently appreciated. One of the features of Europe today is a return of the classical European demons of poisoned pathological politics. Practically every European country, some worse than others, Greece for obvious reasons, but not only Greece, Hungary, and also, by the way, Italy, have seen a return of anti-Semitic, anti-Roma, anti-gay, anti-immigrant policies, not just on the fringes of politics, but really poisoning the whole democratic culture in these countries. So the risk, I don't think, is at all of a revival of any kind of classical interwar dictatorship, but of a poisoned and distorted and deformed democratic politics, which even with respect to the center parties, the non-extremist parties, are conditioned by the return of these pathologies. Now, one response to that is, say, that just shows the project hasn't been pursued vigorously enough, consistently enough. It must be altered in various ways. Press on. It will eventually come out in the wash. I think not. The depth and profundity of the youth unemployment, of the social alienation, of the fact that in some countries, recruitment into the far-right parties is fastest among the young and is often mediated by the internet, is something we should be well aware of. How does that affect Britain's position? Well, I'm not afraid of the consequence, if it ultimately comes to it, that we exit. I don't regard that as, in any sense, disastrous. What I think we're seeing now, in a sense, is that half of Europe, half of 21st century Europe, is being sacrificed in order to solve the 20th century German question. And I'm not sure that's a reasonable trade-off. We have to make a choice in Britain, and as I've said, the preference will be not to make it, but that doesn't mean the willingness to make it in the end is absent. As to whether to commingle our fates with this vast and already tarnished and even failing experiment or exit, then I think the likelihood is we'll exit, and I would support that. A final point is Europe doesn't have 30 or 40 years in which to study its own navel and comment on the changes that may or may not occur because of relatively short-term and inconsequential changes in European politics. The rest of the world is changing much more rapidly than that. Back in 1859, John Stuart Mill, in his book on liberty, wrote in the introduction of European dynamism, I think he used the word energy, and Chinese stationariness. Nobody would now talk about European dynamism. It's a sort of semi-paralyzed, confident, rich in parts of it, the northern parts, doing well, reasonably well for now, but though with lots of inequality and poverty in northern Europe as well. In Germany, no minimum wage, for example. These are all problems which people say will be addressed, but no one could describe Europe as being convulsed by dynamism, or China as being languishing in the depths of lethargic stationariness. the world won't hang on, it won't wait. It will focus on what's actually happening. It will try, as politicians and governments always do, not to pre-commit themselves too much. But if there is a major crisis in the Eurozone, I think it'll be big for obvious reasons. But I just make one comment since I'm speaking in America. I wouldn't take for granted that the net result would be damaging to the US. Obviously, American stock markets, bond markets could be shaken. But even as things are, America is the haven for global capital at the moment. It's flowing from the emerging markets back into America. If there was a major crisis in Europe, that could even accelerate that rate. I think the American experiment, so to speak, of building a genuine nation state, which Europe will never be, has produced something resilient enough that actually the on balance, the net effect could actually be benign in the case of America. So I think we're not in the early stages or the middle of a highly successful an experiment which has problems, which is tarnished, which is difficult, but nonetheless will go on. We're in a period of artificial stasis and artificial stabilization of institutions that are essentially unworkable. And in that context, the British position of remaining detached, whatever its sort of historical reasons, the German support of this project has also got profoundly historical reasons. The German question, which dominated the Dark Continent in much of the 20th century, both emerged from our history. I think that position in Britain has turned out to be not through any excessive wisdom on our part, but has turned out to be the right one that we've adopted. So whatever will happen, we will remain on the side. And European Germans and others may say that's a great tragedy. If so, it's one we can live with.
Final thoughts?
Yeah, just very briefly. I guess one of the interesting features of the last 5 years is that an integral component of the European project, which was there from the start, has been shredded. Right from the start and throughout the 70s and 80s, the idea was that European capitalism was superior to, or the varieties of capitalisms that existed in Europe were superior to the diabolical Anglo-American market individualist model. They were more collaborative, they paid more attention to social cohesion, and so on. Well, no one could say that now. Whether even in the case of Germany, and certainly not in the case of the peripheral countries. So the attachment of the left to a European project is wholly anachronistic, as indeed the project itself has become, partly for the reason that's just been said. When a government in a founder member European country like the Netherlands says welfare state's over, welfare institutions are over, at a time when tens of millions of Europeans are suffering fairly extreme forms of hardship with no prospect, no reliable prospect. Will the wisps emerging from the intricacies and labyrinth of German politics, but nothing more, of any fundamental change of policy? I think it's clear that that's gone. So the notion of Europe embodying a higher, a better, a more intelligent, a more humane, a more socially inclusive form of capitalism is gone. And I think that's one of several realities we should accept. And here, this respect, I do agree with Emmanuel. I think this is one of those periods in history, one of those moments in history, where what we ought to do, what enlightened opinion ought to implement, what can be done, what tweakings and reforms can occur, are really of secondary significance to what is actually happening and is likely to happen. Freud, in one of his wise observations, said it is only in logic that contradictions are forbidden. And one of the contradictions we see at the moment is that the project of transcending national sovereignty in Europe is advancing through a completely national project, that of the Germans, which I agree with Emmanuel on that. I think what I would just want to emphasize is it's not that I want the project to collapse. It's that large-scale projects like the European project, which run into insoluble difficulties, are never rationally dismantled. they simply collapse. The risk, I think, in Europe is more that, unlike the Soviet project, which at least had the energy to collapse, at least had the built-in in a possibility of a heroic reformer who unwittingly produced a collapse, that this situation in Europe may actually continue for decades.
Well, the American experiment is still going.
Yes, but Europe is not America. One of the fundamental errors of American opinion is to assume that Europe can recapitulate American nation building. This is a fundamental error, and I think one of the great challenges in America as the crisis develops, and here I do agree with Emmanuel, is to recognize that that was always mistaken, that America was a largely an occupied country. There were indigenous peoples, but it wasn't constituted by long-standing historic nations as Europe is, densely populated and so on. It's completely impossible, in my view, to recapitulate that experiment in Europe. And I think as long as Americans think that it can be recapitulated, they'll be blind to what's actually going on in Europe.